Next, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine brings you WOOC reporter Dan Pfeiffer, who recently spoke to Surya Matu about smart homes, unsecured databases at Mar-a-Lago, and some of the things our devices are whispering about us that we might not even realize. Surya is a resident at IBM in New York City and a resident of IBM's R&D program for the future of journalism.
We think of it kind of loosely as like a detective agency, but a lot of the research we're doing, we're trying to focus on adversarial research, which we mean looking at the ways technical systems and technologies work, but including within the kind of scope of a technology or algorithmic system, the humans that we make them, and trying to understand like where does the accountability and sort of liability for these systems that are like driving our lives fall, and how can we do research that is actionable, that can be used by advocates, educators, lawyers to kind of steer the navigation, the conversation around the influence of technology in society. And what we're actually doing is we've been going through all of Facebook's terms of service and privacy policies and seeing how they've evolved and changed over time and mapping to them all the legal cases, FTC complaints, and anything else we can find in the public discourse to understand like how these companies have managed to, for 15 years, skirt any kind of accountability and be able to kind of operate and regulate themselves without having any precedent set in the law, just as a way to kind of understand this bigger conversation around this space. It's like they have a privacy policy in terms of service. And when they do that, it's still on us to find how they violate their own services for them to get into trouble. So there's no easy... So even if you read that stuff, it doesn't necessarily tell you what they're doing. It's just telling you what they're saying they're doing.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So I have this really strong visual of you from an earlier project. You're on a boat offshore from Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort holding this huge Wi-Fi antenna. What was going on there?
Yes, I was on a boat in front of Mar-a-Lago, and that was basically an investigation that Jeff Larson, Julia Angwin, and I were doing, which was basically it started really as an investigation of the Trump resort phone apps. We found, we had downloaded like all the apps for like the different golf resorts that Trump has, and we were looking through the data packets we were going through, and we found this URL to a database that looked really unencrypted and unsafe. And the reason we went to Mar-a-Lago was to actually just do like an odd, like a survey of the land, the kind of network infrastructure landscape. So the way to think about it is like we were sitting on our laptops, looking through all the network names that were coming up as we drove around to get a sense for like how many were open, how many were closed, and this type of stuff. And we found some like scary stuff. Like, for example, we found that one of the databases for Mar-a-Lago's backend services actually is loaded over HTTP, the login, which basically means that if someone is like listening in on that network, they can see the credentials to the one of Mar-a-Lago's databases.
You had a quote from a security expert who was saying, we should assume that this has been compromised.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah, because we got that in June of 2017. Trump was already president. The real spies and the real, like, the people who are like experts in this space have probably already figured it all out.
More recently, you did an experiment with Gizmodo journalist Kashmir Hill to snoop on kinds of things, on what kinds of things internet-connected smart products reveal about their users. What did you learn from that?
So when we did this experiment, the real folk, we were less interested in this question from a cybersecurity perspective. Like, we weren't really thinking about, like, who can hack into my devices and how safe are they? We were more thinking about like what are the ambient emissions of a smart home? What does it look like from a network level to live at a smart home? So the way I like kind of pitched the experiment to Cash was, imagine I am the receptionist of your house, and every packet that is coming and going, I just know about. If it's a postcard, I can see what's written on it. If it's a sealed envelope, I can't see what's inside, but I can see that it came and went. And we were just really curious for like different devices. How often do they talk to their servers? What kind of information are they sharing? Could we find any patterns in just the way the house is being lived in through these devices? And we found like some interesting stuff. You know, like I knew when Cash woke up, I knew what Sound app, what Alexa app she used to put her kid to sleep and wake her up. I knew when they watched TV. I knew when she brushed her teeth. And so just all stuff that Comcast, her ISP, could see. And that was the real motivation, because the U.S. government passed a law last year that said they're allowed to sell that data again. They repealed the previous law, which prevented them from doing so. We were just curious what Comcast could see and what they could actually monetize off that data.
She has this quote that says, "Smart homes are dumb." And it seems like it's an article that's as much about how overblown the hype is for a lot of these products, that they're not as smart as they make themselves out to be.
Yeah, I think I think that's basically was, I think, our biggest finding, is that they're kind of creepy, but they're really annoying. And it really made us kind of think about the fact that, you know, like, the current contract we've kind of all agreed upon with these technology companies, that you give us stuff for free and we give you our data in exchange. And that made sense, I think, in like 2005, when like Gmail was giving you gigabytes of inbox space versus Yahoo's 5 MB, right? Like that made, like, that seemed to feel like, yeah, that's worth it, I'll give that up. But now I feel like the models flip, where not only do you buy a $1,000 smart TV and use it, but they also then collect your data, and we don't even think about it because we just take it for granted that that's what's going to happen.
For a few weeks, I had your Facebook friend recommendation tracker running. Could you describe what it does and why you made it?
That was part of an investigation we've been carrying out for the last year around Facebook's people you may know algorithm. When we started this investigation, we were just curious to understand how Facebook suggests people to each other, because, you know, like, that's actually the kind of crux of their business model, is having this massive social graph of people, and they like it when more people are connected to each other because it increases the resolution. So we were just curious how they actually kind of implemented this, and I built us an internal tool, like this internal scraping tool that let us collect all the people. I was being suggested, Cash was being suggested, and we wrote a bunch of stories through this. But what we realized soon after writing these stories was that it was hard to show the harm that this algorithm was doing wasn't actually in the math. It was more in who was not being considered for these decisions. So what we actually found was the LGBTQ community and sex workers were the most harmed by this algorithm, because they had no way of turning it off. So if, for example, as some LGBTQ people told us that they have like a cis identity and a queer identity, and they had both Facebook accounts on their phones, and what Facebook would do was suggest, because the phone was the same, the contacts are the same for both apps, so like someone's mom got suggested that queer identity, someone's old client, so like there's all this stuff that happened, and there's no way for us to navigate that. Facebook doesn't allow that option, the interface. So the reason we built that app was we wanted our readers and users to collect their own data and share their stories with us, because that's how we wanted to hold the challenges with this algorithm into account. We hear so many anecdotes of how people have these experiences, but none of it's recorded in a way that we can actually take it, like raise it to a higher level. So that's kind of, that sort of anecdote was exactly the motivation of the app.
Let's see. So a while back, you showed me a tool that you're working on called Herbivore, which looked like a great way to learn about computer networks. How is that coming along?
Herbivore is like a network inspection tool. It's sort of like a packet sniffer. If people have heard of Wireshark, which is like an old version of this, it's a thing that's existed for a long time. The real motivation for behind Herbivore, though, was to build a tool that allows us to talk about computer networks more from the perspective of the politics of the companies involved in that conversation, and less from just the technical layer. So what it tries to do is get you to the part where you're actually seeing how your devices are communicating with servers of companies, and what information is being transacted, and what the motivations behind that information being shared could be, and how that affects you. So kind of really, like, the goal was to really take the sniffing part of packet sniffing to the next degree, where instead of telling you how something works, can we make you smell how a network feels?
I love that metaphor. How does a network smell?
Yeah, because like, it's a different response. Like, that's gross. Or like, that's nice. But it's different to like, how do I feel about this? In like a abstract way.
So I understand you're going to be a TED speaker. That's kind of weird and amazing. Are you preparing your talk? What is that process like?
That was totally out of the blue. So when we released the smart home story 2 weeks ago, the next day we got an email from one of the people who curates the TED speakers and said, hey, there's this conference happening in 2 months and we'd love for you to come and talk about the story with us. And I was like, what? and I guess like, you know, privacy still fits within the concerns of the neoliberal model. So it makes sense that TED wants us to go there. But yeah, so we're going to talk about the story and we're currently in the middle of like figuring out what the big idea is. And I think like what I'm trying to tease out is how do you, like I was saying earlier, how do you frame privacy in a way that's not about like the effects to an individual, but to us as a community?
That was Dan Pfeiffer talking to Surya Matu as part of his series on data justice. To learn more about Surya's projects, you can visit suryamatu.com. That's suryamatu.com.